Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me today is editor Simon Lambert. And coming up, remember shopfaces, hot tubs, garden furniture? Our tastes have changed somewhat over the last few years when it comes to our homes. So what improvements really boost value if you're looking to sell? Also today, banking shares have been caught up in a sharp sell-off this year, but has the dust now settled? And could UK banks be a good investment? Will Schroder UK Public Private Trust ever distance itself from Neil Woodford? And savings rates are fast approaching the 5% mark, with competition at the top of This Is Money's Best Buy savings tables at boiling point. We take a look at what's on offer. Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, open plan living areas, neutral decor, and hot tubs could at one time boost selling prices of homes by thousands of pounds. But our tastes have changed dramatically due to the pandemic and rising living costs. The Humble Conservatory, for example, can drag down the value of your home by as much as 15 grand when you come to sell. And this is not the only feature that's fallen out of favour. So what is out and what is in? Simon, what's wrong with conservatories? How have our tastes changed in recent years?
There's nothing necessarily wrong with a conservatory. And I say that for all our podcast listeners who have a conservatory attached to their house. Conservatories were once all the rage. They definitely put a timestamp on a property. I'm not going to say they date a property. I'm going to say they put a timestamp on a property. There was a conservatory boom, for example. And the problem is that if you've got a well-built conservatory that's well-insulated, say perhaps you've got well-built walls underneath some well-double-glazed windows with a well-fitting door and a decent roof on it, then you might be able to use that conservatory happily all year round. You might just need a radiator or a heater in there, and it's perfectly warm in the winter. And as long as it's not facing the blazing sun, it might not be too hot in the summer. And it may even be fairly easily accessible off your house. You might treat it as another room, for example. However, there are many conservatories that are not like that. There are many conservatories that are fairly flimsy and ill-constructed glass structures tacked onto the side of a house where a salesman came round, spoke to perhaps the previous owners. Let's blame it on the previous owners rather than you. And they went, yeah, all right, that sounds great. I get another room that's going to change my life. I'll be able to sit out there warm in the winter and
read
in the summer. It'll be like sitting outdoors, but indoors. It'll only cost me 10 grand and it's going to be fantastic. And unfortunately, then when they said, and can I open up that wall so it's just completely open onto the house? The conservatory people said, well, actually, yeah, you can't technically do that. Yeah, sort of planning and building regulations means that you need to have a separate door into the conservatory, so you can't just open it up. And it became an impractical dumping ground. And maybe people toughed it out and they got their chairs out there and they enjoyed the indoor-outdoor experience. And then they sort of stopped doing it a bit, and then they, you know, just wasn't so great, and then they sort of started putting things in there, or maybe they sold it to someone else, and somebody else bought it, and they went, well, you know what, it's another room, it's extra space, but actually I'm never going to sit in it. And then they've never turned it into another room. They realized that it wasn't really usable space, and they've got a sort of bike, kids toys, dog stuff. I mean, I've seen people turn them into laundry rooms, which means that you then have a laundry room that enjoys the indoors-outdoors experience tacked onto the back of your lounge, when really most people tend to prefer to hide their laundry rooms away. I mean, I know there is a trend for laundry rooms at the moment, and actually laundry rooms are the things that will add value to your house right now, but they do need to kind of be tucked away rather than the sort of the predominant feature as the house blends into the garden. It's like, ooh, I love your garden and your tumble dryer.
so people don't want them.
No. Yeah, and energy is the big thing, isn't it? everybody's been trying to save energy this year because the costs have gone through the roof. And that's just made conservatories even less popular, to the point where some estate agents are claiming, and I'm saying claiming here because I think the right house in the right location for the right person will sell, whether it's got a conservatory on the back or not. But some agents are claiming that buyers are actively not looking for properties with conservatories. They're turning them down, or they are making offers that actually devalues the property due to the conservatory. So for example, they say, well, it's going to cost me 15 grand to turn that conservatory into a usable room. The easiest way of doing that is actually to take the glass or perspex roof off, put a proper roof on, make sure the windows are all good, make sure the doors are all good. But that's an expensive job, and maybe you need to put some central heating in there if there isn't central heating in there. So ratcheting all this up and going, well, that's going to cost me 15 grand, so I'll pay 15 grand less for the house. And that's why there's an argument devaluing houses.
I feel like I've learned just so much from this conversation, Simon. As someone who's looking at properties at the moment, I just assumed a conservatory was a good thing.
Well, it can be. And I know lots of people who do have conservatories that are a good thing. My mum effectively has a conservatory on the back of her house. It spans between the kitchen and a playroom, and it creates a much larger kind of like seating dining area off the back of the kitchen. And, you know, because her and my dad weren't too concerned about the fact that, you know, they might have building regs and stuff like that, it is actually open onto the house, you know, which you can do. It's just, you can do that. It just might be a problem when you come to sell.
Yeah.
You know, someone might say, well, you're going to have to put a door back in there in order for me to buy the house. And you go, okay, fine. Well, I can either put the door in, or, you know, I can take a bit of money off and you can put the door in if you want, or you can just not bother to put the door in. But, you know, but there's lots of conservatories that are like perfectly good, usable bits of houses that people very much enjoy. Not to say that there are not many, many shonky conservatories. And I know where the germ of an idea for this story came from.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Came from a certain Mr. Lee Boyce.
Sitting on a shonky one.
He had a conservatory on his house, and he did sort it out by putting a proper roof on it. But he was sitting on the train looking out the window, going past people's gardens and seeing all these sort of slightly shonky conservatories, and thought, I wonder what that's actually doing to people's houses when they're trying to sell them. And so he got some people who could do some digging.
And that is the conclusion. But what else have you found? Obviously, energy is a big concern, will be going forward. So that sort of explains conservatories there. What else? What other themes? I mean, I was quite surprised reading this article that open plan living room, kitchen, I think they're called American kitchens, is that right? Don't seem to be in favour anymore. Again, another thing that I thought was a good thing.
Well, you can have too much of a good thing, can't you, Georgie? I mean, apparently,
they say that. I'd never thought about that in terms of, you know,
had too much of space. A good thing. So the trend towards open plan is an interesting one. And again, this is a trend. You can, if you see a house that's almost totally open plan, it puts a timestamp on it. You're like, right, that's a 2010s house. Okay, that's where this big, you know, trend for doing it came from. And there's a logic to it, okay? Because if you've got your kitchen, your dining area, and then a seating area by there, that's great because it mixes the whole family together. You know, you spend lots of time in the kitchen cooking, you're then going to be eating, and then it's quite close to the kitchen. And I'll tell you a really interesting thing about changes in trends in a minute when I finish saying that. But then you've got the dining table next to there, but it's a nice open room rather than being shoved away in a little room somewhere else in the house that you never ever use. And I make a huge apology to all of our listeners living in small flats that they own or they rent, and they're listening to me talking about rooms that are dining rooms tucked away somewhere and going, oh my god, this is I can't handle this any longer. But we're talking about the people
two bedroom flat, don't worry about it.
And then you've got your little seating area where perhaps you can sit and watch a bit of TV while someone's cooking, the kids can sit and watch a movie, it means they can talk to the parents while they're cooking, maybe they could do a bit of studying. They're probably just watching Netflix, that kind of thing. So it works, but you can go too far. I've seen houses where they've open planned almost the entire downstairs. So there's nowhere to escape. People can't watch one thing in one room and one thing in the other. Yeah. Or you can't listen to the radio while you're cooking. because somebody's watching the TV. Turn that down. No, you turn that down. Or actually, nobody says turn that down. You just get a sound clash and they both get louder and louder and louder and louder. I've seen a house for sale, a very expensive house for sale, where someone had extended it and renovated it, and they had literally created an open plan U-shape that absorbed the whole of the massive downstairs of this house. So the only bit that wasn't open plan was the entrance hall and the staircase, and then you had what would have been one lounge on one side and then either a playroom or a dining room on the other side, and then they'd done the big kitchen diner at the back, and it was just one massive U-shape. And people's experience of living in those places is, God, I wish there was a wall.
Okay.
And then COVID happened, lockdown, house arrest. Yeah. You can't get out and you can't even go to a different room unless you go sit in your bedroom upstairs because the entire house is open plan. People are working, people are homeschooling, people are watching Netflix. And so, yes, broken plan is the new thing. It's having open plan, but maybe broken up a bit so you can have that little bit of privacy or something, and also not doing the crazy open plan the entire house thing. And before we stop on open plan, here's my interesting little fact. I live in a house that was built in the 60s. The people we bought the house off bought the house brand new in 1962. They didn't change it that much. It's a bit of a time warp house, and we actually have a broken plan space from before broken plan was a thing. So we have a little kitchen, and then off the little kitchen there's a dining area. It's not very big. It's only like kind of 2.5 meters by 3 meters. It's just big enough to fit the dining table and walk around it and stuff like that. But between the kitchen and the dining area, it is open, except there is a kind of wooden framework partition in there that is open. But of course, in the 60s, you didn't want the magic to be ruined. You didn't want people seeing you cooking, or you didn't want to be seeing the sink or the cooker or the evidence that anyone had cooked when you were sitting down to have your junior executive dinner party. So you can close off that open plan bit. There are some blinds that come down between the gaps of the wooden frame, and there's a sliding door that comes across, and so you can create the illusion that you're just in a dining room and you cannot see the kitchen. And then there's a folding door into the lounge bit as well, and people look at it and it's like, that's really quite inconvenient, because you know what you want to do is open it up. And I must admit, we don't ever close those blinds and close the door and pretend that we can't see the dining room from the kitchen or the kitchen from the dining room. But it is quite an interesting thing. And you know what, having lived in it for a few years, it does sort of work, because what you can do when you're cooking, because the kitchen is quite small, is you can just boot everybody out of the kitchen and go, you lot all go stand in there. And there's a pen basically where you can make them go stand, so they're not getting in your way in the kitchen.
Right. Okay. I'm learning, honestly, Simon, learning so much.
But, yeah. Do we want to run through the...
I was going to say, should we run through it? Yeah, let's run through what else can bring the value down, and then we'll go through the ones that can bring value up. And how much are we talking here?
Okay, so energy guzzlers. These are a big out at the moment. The main one, swimming pools. Who wouldn't want a swimming pool, hey?
Have swimming pools ever been in? I just thought that they were, just especially in this country, you only use them for like 2 days a year, don't you?
This is why swimming pools make homes hard to sell. You just hit the nail on the head. But they're even more out at the moment, because not only have you got people going, well, we'd only use it for 2 days a year, and then their partner's going, I would love a swimming pool, it would be amazing, we could have great pool parties, I'd swim every morning even in winter. And the other partner's going, no, you wouldn't, you'd only use it for 2 days a year. They're now going, and it'll cost an absolute fortune. People have gone, well, do you know what? Wouldn't it be great to have an indoor pool? You really could use that in all year round. I bet there aren't many people thinking it's great to have an indoor pool, I can use that all year round this year. They go, turn it off. So yes, swimming pools have always dramatically narrowed down the pool of potential buyers, and they have become more of a drag on a property's value. And I would say that arguably, you know, there are scenarios where a pool will take value off rather than adding value in terms of you're just massively reducing the competition. I mean, obviously, there's, once you move into mansion territory, then, you know, everybody wants the pool, but actually, I'm not even sure whether they do, but yeah. So hot tubs as well. I mean, obviously, most hot tubs are portable and can be taken with people. They don't always get sold or rarely get sold with the house. But if you've got a built-in hot tub, that's just going to be seen as an energy guzzler. And actually just poor energy ratings. And one thing that you'd think would add value, but there's some debate as to whether it does yet, is electric car charging points. And also the other thing that detracts is bad extensions or ill thought out extensions or renovations where you try to carve out extra space, but you carve out not particularly usable extra space, or you end up taking two rooms and you split them. And instead of having one nice big room, you have two rooms that are now too small. So those are the kind of things that detract.
Right. Well, let's now look at the positives, Simon.
Okay. Should we do this from the sort of the bottom to the top?
Do it.
Okay. Actually, do you know what? The list is not necessarily from the bottom to the top in terms of percentage. It's only in terms of adding value. But I'm just going to run through it in no particular order. Garage conversion. Average cost, $13,750. Added value on a not average size, average price, £287,000 home, 10%. It's going to add £28,700. And that's basically people taking their garage and turning it into a usable part of the house rather than a dumping ground for junk. Although people do tend to like to have some kind of dumping ground for junk. They just don't need a whole big garage size room to do it. Garden office adds 7.5% value to your home. Average cost here, $9,500. Profit, $12,000. But you know what? Garden offices can cost you a lot more than that. Utility room adds 5% to the value of your house. Full decoration, 3%. Loft conversion. Now, this is often a very cost-effective way of adding space if you've got the head height. It's expensive. Average cost is £37,500, but it could add 15% to the value of your house, which would mean that you're making a £5,600 profit, which doesn't seem like that much, actually. I think if you do it well and add an extra bedroom, you could probably bag a bit more than that. Solar panels, they'll only add 4%. Kitchen upgrade will add 5.5%. Electric car charging point, only 1.7%. Extension, approximately 20 square meters. Average cost, £40,000. Added value, 15%. So you're actually not making that much profit because the cost of the extension is so expensive. And there may be many people listening to this who have looked at doing extensions and thinking, I wish I could do the extension for £40,000. Extensions are very expensive at the moment. Building work is expensive. Bathroom upgrade, 2.6% added value. And finally, the landscaped garden, a 1.4% added value, could cost you £3,750. Would add £4,025 to your property's value. So you're only making a £275 profit, but you'd probably enjoy that a huge amount. So what price your enjoyment?
There's a question. Right, moving on, Simon, UK banking shares. They've taken a thrashing in recent weeks following the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and concerns over wider issues within the banking system still abound. Despite fears of further collapses and possible bank runs, the contagion in the UK's banking sector has been limited. While investor sentiment has taken a hit, FTSE 100 listed banks have started to stage a tentative recovery. So, is now a good entry point for investors looking for exposure in the market, or are there wider issues at play within sectors? Simon, if you would just explain to me what's been happening to UK banking shares.
UK banking shares are something that's just been in the doldrums for a very long time. Everybody always says they're cheap, they're going to make lots of money, they're going to go up, and then they go up a bit, and then something happens and they fall down again. And there is an argument made by investors in some quarters that you need to think about banking stocks more as utilities nowadays. The profits that were once there just aren't there. You also need to think about banks in terms of, what does that bank do? Is it primarily a retail bank, i.e. it serves customers, savers, borrowers, and so on, and is more sort of directly reflective of what's going on in the overall economy? So a bank like that would be Lloyds, for example. Is it a more of an investment bank, or a bank that combines the two things. So Barclays, for example, combines a big consumer division with a large amount of investment banking and a big investment banking presence. Is it a global mega bank like HSBC, for example? Or is it a bank that is a challenger bank, an up-and-coming bank, one that's tailored to more of a niche? You've got the challenger banks like the Monzos, the Starlings, neither of those are stock market listed. And then you've also got the banks that we've seen a bit of trouble with over in the US, Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, and so on. So you need to think about what kind of bank it is. And the excitement has been around the smaller challenger banks, the ones servicing this kind of special markets. But those are the ones that have probably suffered more in the recent crisis, apart from Credit Suisse, which has been a basket case for ages.
Yeah, indeed. Are people right to be concerned?
Well, yes, in a way. And no, they don't need to be too worried. Firstly, right. if you've got your money in the bank, your savings in the bank, which is most people's major concern, then you are protected by the Financial Services Compensation Scheme, up to £85,000 per individual, per individually licensed bank. If you make sure that you don't have more than that in a bank, then your money is protected and you're absolutely fine. There has been some talk about raising that limit, which is interesting because the £85,000 comes from being tied to the European banking protection scheme. Obviously, we're not tied to that anymore due to Brexit. And actually, if you look in the US, the limit is $250,000. So it's actually considerably higher. And there is an argument that you could make the limit higher. The argument for that is that by making the limit higher, you reduce the chance of a bank run because more of people's money is protected. So they feel more confident and therefore you never need to use the limit anyway. And also that limit hasn't moved up with inflation, for example, since it was put in place. And the Bank of England, I think, and the government are seriously considering this. In terms of, do you need to worry about the banking sector? I mean, we talked about this when the SVB thing was unfolding the other week. It was like, well, hang on a minute. We spent ages saying banks are much more robust and safer now than they were. And they are. But there is a problem with some of the banks in that. And it's less of a problem in this country where the rules are tighter, but it's more of a problem in the US where some of the smaller banks have not been held to the same standards in terms of capital as the bigger banks. And it means that they don't have to mark to market. A mark to market means that you have to regularly revalue the assets that you're holding. So they're holding assets in the form of government bonds, which means that if everybody starts to take their money out, they can sell these liquid assets, get some money and give people their money. But the problem is that some of those government bonds that they're holding were issued by governments when interest rates were much, much lower than they are now. And if you hold that government bond until its maturity, you will get all of your money back and you'll pick up the interest rate return. So you've got a fixed rate of return. But if you have to sell that bond before it finishes, people might not pay you the face value of that bond. If that bond started at $100 and it only pays 0.25% interest, why is someone going to give you $100 for it when they could go buy one that pays 4% interest now for $100? So you've got to knock down the price of yours until the yield is roughly equal with what they could get on a new bond. And what happened with Silicon Valley Bank was it needed to raise some money. It tried to do a big bond sale. It didn't get the bond sale away and raise all the money that it wanted to because it got marked down and everybody panicked a little bit. That mark to market stuff happens way more commonplace across the banking system in Europe and the UK, so it's a bit less of an issue. We've got lots of reassurances about the banking sector, but that's what bankers are meant to do. They're meant to reassure you that everything is fine. It's a confidence trick, as we've spoken about before. I don't think that there is a major banking crisis, but, you know, lots of people didn't think there was a major banking crisis last time there was one until it blew up in their faces. But I do think there might be a few more problems that unfold. We're not out of the woods yet, basically. Right.
So with that in mind, is now a good time to invest in UK banks? I repeat the question at the start. Is now a good entry point for investors looking for exposure or their wider issues at play?
Well, potentially because they are cheap. A lot of this stuff is in the price already. The price has been so knocked down off the negative sentiment. You would think that at some point there would be a re-rating, there would be an improvement in sentiment. Higher interest rates are generally good for banking profits, but as they looked like they were picking up, along rumbled another banking crisis. So you need to be aware of that. So what I would say is, yes, if you want to buy some Lloyds shares because you think they're cheap, yes, if you want to buy some Barclays shares because you think they're cheap, then by all means, make them part of your portfolio, but part of your portfolio, you know, a small amount. Don't over bet or over, don't be overly reliant on them, because, you know, they can suddenly drop. Something happens and all of a sudden they're down another 20% or something like that. And look, as I've been sitting on Lloyds shares forever and a day, because I have Lloyds shares because I was a Halifax member when Halifax demutualized, and I was just old enough to get some free shares. I then ended up with them becoming Lloyds shares in the financial crisis. There was then a rights issue a couple of times where they needed to raise money, and they raised money at a discount to the share price. So I bought some more shares then, and I've been sitting on them in the expectation that they got to go to 100p sometime soon for many, many years. As listeners to this podcast who've heard me tell this story before will know. And you know what? Every time they ever start making some headway, something comes along and down they fall again.
Which sort of makes me think, are all banks created equal in this? Are some better investments than others? And what should you really be thinking about when you're choosing?
I think you should be thinking about the opportunity cost of what else you could be doing with your money. That, yes, they might look like a bargain, they might look really good, but are they actually going to be able to make, you know, the bumper profits that they made in the past? Probably not, because there's lots of things they've had to do. Like, quite a lot of the bumper profits from the UK banking industry came from mis-selling people PPI, and they had to stop doing that and then pay all the money back. That then meant that they made, you know, they lost a lot of that money in the years gone past. And you have to think about, well, you know, okay, well, I think Lloyds is cheap, but what else do I think is cheap? What's the opportunity cost of putting the money in Lloyds? I can't put the money into something else. Should I put it into something, another stock I think is cheap, might have better prospects, or should I just put it into a fund or an investment trust that diversifies my money, and that means I don't have to worry about individual stock risk? Or, as we talked about the other week, should I just Mary Kondo it and hold up my investment, and instead of asking does it bring me joy, hold it up and ask, does it do anything better than a cheap global tracker fund, and should I just put my money in there instead?
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam Northby Toro for our weekly look at what's been happening on the markets. Sam, how's the past week been?
Yeah, pretty interesting. We had over half of the S&P 500 companies reporting this week, and almost half of the Dow Jones ones too. It's been by far the most anticipated week of earnings this quarter. Meta and Amazon did pretty well. Tech in general has actually performed pretty well, albeit Google not so much this week. And we've got to wait to see how Amazon do as well. The stock market at the moment is on course for its second down week in a row, and I think that's not completely unexpected, to be honest. We had a very good run and we needed a bit of a break from that, and we've got that over the last couple of weeks. However, there is a little bit of a worry, and that worry is seasonality. April is typically the best month of the year, but May until October is a pretty average period. So we'll have to see how that goes. Ultimately, I still do think we remain higher this year, but I expect some bumps in the road. Other points of note this week include the latest US GDP number, which was pretty mixed, came in lower than expectations, but the consumer spending side of it was actually not too bad. It sets things up really nicely for next week's FOMC meeting, but volatility ahead is what I expect.
So other than that big decision next week, what else do we have to look forward to?
Yeah, so, well, UK shortened week, but that doesn't mean there isn't a lot for us to keep an eye on. As I mentioned, the most important thing is going to be that monetary policy decision from the FOMC, who are expected on Wednesday to raise interest rates for the last time in this cycle. As always, forward guidance will be critical to how markets react in the medium term. Whilst that is the biggest event, there are other things we need to consider. And also, as mentioned, we've had that biggest and most anticipated week for earnings, but there's some real big companies reporting next week. They include Pfizer, HSBC, Starbucks, Estee Lauder, Shell, and probably the big one, Apple too. Other macro events, ECB monetary policy decision, unemployment rate and inflation from the Eurozone, the latest jobs number from the US, and some interesting data points from Japan and China too, who are at different points in their cycles compared to Europe, UK and the US. So an interesting week. As I said, a bit of volatility is what I would expect.
And it's going to be more about what the Fed say than what they actually do.
100%. Yeah, that's the press conference. So that'll be 30 minutes after the announcement. I think that's where we're going to get the most out of what they say.
Well, thank you very much, Sam. We'll pick up on what actually happened next week.
Thanks, Simon.
Welcome back. What's in a name? Well, quite a lot, actually. Schroder UK Public Private Trust might be in the process of changing its name, but it's still struggling to distance itself from Neil Woodford. The trust, previously Woodford Patient Capital Trust and soon to be renamed Schroder Capital Global Innovation, was one of the UK's biggest when it raised £800 million in 2015. But now it's staring down the barrel of another tough year. So, Simon, a bit of a history lesson here, if you would, and why, indeed, does this story matter?
It matters because this is the artist formerly known as Woodford Patient Capital Trust, which was Neil Woodford's investment trust, in which the clue was in the name, patient. Investors were expected to be patient, to buy into long shot investments, a mix of publicly listed companies, stock market listed companies, and some private companies. And they were the kind of stocks that were companies that were showed great promise, disruptive technology, disruptive ideas, disruptive healthcare was a big part of it. And if you bought into these things early on and you were patient, then they would grow and they would grow and they would grow, and you would eventually make lots of money. Arguably, if Neil Woodford wanted to switch from being a steady eddy UK equity income investor who targeted companies because of their dividends and had delivered great returns for investors over the years, thanks to his approach, if he wanted to shift from that into becoming an exciting tech, biotech, healthcare, you know, disruptive company investor, he should have just done it in this investment trust. He should have just set up an investment trust, which is a much better investment vehicle for holding illiquid companies, whether they're publicly listed small companies or with the volatility in their share price, which means you might not be able to sell them when you need to, or privately listed companies. He should have just bought them in this investment trust, because the great thing about an investment trust is it's something known as closed-ended. It has two prices: the net asset value, which is the value of the things it holds, and it has the share price, which is the cost of buying a share to get in and out. And you hold shares, and when people buy shares, they buy them off the people who've already got them. And when people sell shares, they sell them to somebody who wants to buy them. It doesn't get bigger or smaller as money comes in or out. That was what killed his fund, was the fact that loads of people poured money in. So he had to go out and buy loads of investments. And then when people tried to take the money out, he had to sell loads of investments. With an investment trust, you're not a forced buyer or a forced seller. It's a much better way to invest in this kind of higher risk, illiquid stuff, whether it's individual companies or also whether it's properties. You know, it's a much better way of investing directly in property than doing it through a fund. And if he'd just done this with this trust and then done what he was meant to with his other fund, the Woodford Equity Income Fund, that was people expected to be much more that classic Woodford steady eddy thing, there probably wouldn't have been the same problem. Unfortunately, there was a real blurring between the two. You know, but lots of people bought into it because of the Woodford name. And it turned out that some of these bets went bad. Some of the companies weren't so great. There had to be, there was, when the fund was shuttered and Woodford was booted out, there was all kinds of problems. And it turned into a, you know, a disaster for anybody who had invested in it. I mean, it turned into a career disaster for Neil Woodford, but Neil Woodford made an awful lot of money out of his career disaster, whereas most of his investors instead lost lots of money. So basically, after the debacle happened, Schroders picked up this investment trust and they had a sort through the portfolio. They sold a few things, they bought a few things. And, you know, while there were a few real gems in there when Schroders took over the management, they then got hit by the pandemic. So you had the stock market crash of the pandemic. Then you had the stock market shoot back up. You had the trust selling assets to other companies with an argument that the trust basically had sold some of these assets too cheaply. And one of the biggest detractors to the portfolio has been the performance of one of its biggest holdings, Oxford Nanopore, which is a DNA sequencing company. It listed in London to much fanfare, with its share price soaring as much as 45% on its debut. Since then, however, its performance has dragged on the trust because the shares are now down 65%. So there's been a bit of disappointment within here. So to give the top 10 holdings, it's Oxford Nanopore, Atom Bank, AMO Pharma, Reaction Engines, Benevolent AI, Federated Wireless, HP Environmental Technologies Fund, Genomics, Immunocore, Back Market. It's a risky investment. It's an investment for patient investors. And there's, you know, quite a bit more kind of private investments in there than most people would probably want to hold. And there is a big question over this stuff because of the rise in interest rates, making jam tomorrow companies much less attractive to people. Imagine it as an individual. If you can just put your money into a savings account that's going to pay you 4.9% now, or 4.7%, 4.6% over 1 year, then the rate that some risky company has to deliver you needs to be much higher to tempt you to go into the risky company. So you're less likely to do it. So there's less demand for those risky companies. But whereas before, when a savings account would only pay you 0.5%, you're like, well, I might as well try and take that risky company because that risky company only needs to make 5% in a year. And then that will be 4.5% greater than the 0.5% I'm making. Whereas if now you can get 4.5% in the savings account, you're like, well, that risky company is going to need to make 9% in a year in order to beat it. And I don't think that risky company can average a 9% a year return. So
where will it go from here, Simon?
I don't know. It's difficult to tell. It's having another shake up. I think it might be the case that these investments, if people are patient, will pay off, that there's a lot of good companies in here. We've already seen a bit of a turnaround in sentiment towards some of the kind of growth stock names. The Nasdaq's done very well this year, just off the expectation the Fed's going to stop raising interest rates sometime soon. Maybe investors are getting ahead of themselves. Well, maybe actually some of that stuff just doesn't matter. Maybe that's noise. The interesting thing, if you speak to, for example, Scottish Mortgage Managers, who another investment trust, very high profile, and that did very, very well, but has really been knocked off its perch. It's trading at a 20% discount to its NAV. Its shares have fallen 50%, I think, from their peak. And it's been hit by this change in sentiment towards these kind of growth stocks, towards holding private companies where people are worried about the valuations. Are they going to be marked down because they're not marked to market in the same way, going back to what we were saying a minute ago? But the managers say, look, if these companies are successful and they do what they're trying to do, and even just a few of them succeed, even just a few outliers succeed, the success that they achieve and the growth that they get off the back of it, the genuine world-changing disruptive growth will more than outweigh the losses from the companies that fall by the wayside. It's this theory of the asymmetry of returns. But you have to be aware that that's what you're buying into. And again, should only be a small part of your portfolio if you are, not a major part, because otherwise you're taking a really, really big risk with your money.
So before we move on from this, I just want to ask you one question about what we've learned, I suppose, from the whole Neil Woodford debacle. I mean, he was the star fund manager. A lot of hubris. Are we still in a position where that can happen again? Are we a bit more cautious now?
You'd like to think not. That we're not a bit more cautious. You'd like to think not that it couldn't happen again. You'd like to think that regulators would be paying more attention, that administrators actually, and the finger has been pointed to do with Woodford at the fund's administrators link. Administrators would be much more careful about checking that fund managers are doing what they sort of claim they're doing. and the regulators as well, that if the fund manager is sort of projecting an image of this, that they are actually then doing that with their investment fund. But you'd also like to think that investors are a bit more careful about what they're actually investing in and what's in their fund. And the one thing I would say in Neil Woodford's defense is that his fund, even his equity income fund, did the rare thing of listing all of its holdings. And so people, if they did go and look, could see exactly what was in the fund. So investors could have checked and gone, hang on a minute, this guy's not doing the kind of thing that he used to be doing. But it's human nature that you don't necessarily do that. And lots of people have lots of different investments and they don't have time to pour through it. And they rely on trust and also all the regulation that's in place. And there's quite a lot of regulation in place around the fund management industry. Mm. So you would have liked to have thought that the Woodford thing couldn't happen. And, you know, there's a suggestion of, you know, a degree of kind of, you know, investment platform complicity in this, media complicity even. But we were running stories and other our rivals also were running stories about Woodford's poor performance and what exactly was Woodford investing in quite a long time before the Woodford fund blew up. And they weren't happy about it, but it's a difficult one, isn't it? You can't write a story that says everybody should pull all of their money out of this now. And that's a pretty strong line to take. So yeah, I think it's a complicated picture, to be honest, but you'd like to think that something like that wouldn't happen again. It almost certainly will at some point in the future.
That's something to think about. Right, Simon, you mentioned about savings rates there. Fixed savings rates are racing to 5% at the moment. In anticipation of further interest rate hikes, Al Ryan Bank, they've launched a 3-year deal paying 4.9%, and experts say they expect other banks to follow suit. Simon, I thought we'd peaked and we were sort of seeing rates potentially on the wane.
We thought we'd peaked too. We kept telling you we'd peaked, didn't we? That was the word on the street. In easy access rates were probably going to continue to tickle up a bit, but it looked like fixed rates had peaked. The mini budget panic, you know, the rate spike after that had ebbed away. Mortgage rates have come down. But no. Fixed rates are back on the rise. It's a strong possibility that we are going to see a 5-year fixed rate. We have managed to get all the way up to 4.9% this week. So come on, savings providers. Do it. And we did actually breach 5% slightly over the autumn. And cool. So we could theoretically do it now as well.
Tell me about Al Ryan and what they're offering.
Okay, so Al Ryan has a 3-year fix paying 4.9%. That's the highest fixed rate deal currently on the market. Now, what you need to remember is that Al Ryan's accounts require a minimum deposit of £5,000 and no withdrawals can be made until the end of the term. All deposits are protected under the Financial Services Compensation Scheme, up to £85,000 per person. The account can be opened online or through its digital banking app or by telephone. And the really big and, it's an Islamic bank. So it's Sharia compliant. And so instead of paying interest to savers, what happens is it invests customers' deposits in ethical Sharia-compliant activities to generate a profit, and it then pays out an expected profit rate. The expected profit rate is the 4.9%. Since the bank was founded in 2004, it has always paid at least the profit rate it has quoted to its customers. So you can expect to get that 4.9%. But I mean, you can also look at some of the other best fixed rates if that's not up your street. For example, the top 1 year at the moment, that is Al Ryan again at 4.75, but you've got Smart Save Bank at 4.71, Close Brothers at 4.7, Shawbrook at 4.7. If you look over 2 years, you've got Al Ryan again at the top, 4.85. You then got Smart Save 4.71, Close Brothers at 4.7, Investec at 4.7. And then over 3 years, Al Ryan to 4.9, Smart Safe at 4.71, Close Brothers at 4.7. Are you noticing something here? They're offering the same rates across different time periods. And in fact, weirdly, the top 5-year fixed rate isn't Al Ryan for a start.
Yeah.
It's Atom Bank, and that's 4.65%. So you'll get paid a lower rate for locking your money away for 5 years. And this reflects the expectation that interest rates might have to go up another couple of times more than people think. Does it reflect the fact that the banks are keen to get people's cash and keep hold of their cash? Going back to what we were talking about, the shake up in the banking industry earlier, I think there is a little bit of that going on. So it's good news for savers because they're seeing rates tickle up, and you've seen Marcus raise rates this week. You've seen Nationwide raise rates this week. So it's good news. The bad news is inflation is still above 10%.
But expected to fall.
And there will come a point at which those two charts cross each other. And if you put your money into a one-year fixed rate, then at some point over the next year, if Rishi Sunak's maths is right, and we know Rishi's good at maths, don't we?
Yeah.
Inflation will halve, and then it will come down a little bit more, and the two charts will cross, and you'll be making a real return on your money. And Ed Magnus, our savings guru, has done some number crunching on this, as we know, regular listeners to the podcast, and he has confirmed to us that if all predictions are correct, then you should start to make a real return on a fixed rate savings account at some point later this year or in the early part of next year, if all predictions are correct.
Indeed. And they're always correct, aren't they, Simon? Right, that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon,
you can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join in the debate and read the comments and see all podcasts past.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.